Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Thanks for joining me. I'm Keri Phillips.
China has made a number of concessions to the US in a bid to avert an all-out trade war.
It may have been all smiles for the cameras, but the grip and grin masks deep and festering economic differences. The Washington get-together is aimed at resolving mounting trade tensions that are threatening to poison an already edgy relationship.
There is a growing skepticism in each country about the other's intentions. Unfortunately, in America, this is manifesting itself as anti-China sentiment as China becomes a symbol of the real and imagined downside of global competition.
Today we'll look at the history behind the growing tension in a relationship that some economists compare to that between a drug addict and his dealer. China is the world's biggest saver, with about $1.5 trillion held in foreign currency reserves. Although the precise composition of China's foreign currency holdings is a secret, many economists believe that as much as three-quarters could be held in US dollars, mostly in the form of treasury bonds. We can think of these as IOUs, guaranteed by the US government, which needs to borrow money to cover things like its expensive tax cuts and military adventures. And because Americans are not good savers, but appear addicted to cheap Chinese-made consumer goods, there's now also a huge imbalance in the trade flow between the two countries. This volatile economic embrace began with a historic handshake in 1972.
President Nixon can expect a courteous but quiet welcome when he reaches Peking later today. That's the prediction of all the newsmen I've spoken to in China's capital.
There is no reason for us to be enemies. Neither of us seeks the territory of the other. Neither of us seeks domination over the other. Neither of us seeks to stretch out our hands and rule the world.
Nicholas R. Lardy is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C.
Before Nixon's visit to China in 1972, there was virtually no trade between the two countries. The United States had imposed an embargo on trade with China during the Korean War, and it basically lasted right up until the time of the visit. Now, China was near the bottom of the world in terms of per capita income. There's a debate about exactly what it was, but it was extremely small. The United States was at or near the top, depending on what methodology you use. So the two countries were polar opposites in terms of level of per capita income on a global scale. And China was not a significant player in the international economy. It was about the 40th ranked trading economy. Its trade was minuscule. Its importance as a trading nation was actually much, much smaller than it had been in the 1950s. So they were polar opposites, both in terms of level of income on a per capita basis and in participation in the global economy as measured by trade. And, of course, in terms of finance, the United States was a leading player in the global financial system. China at that time had no foreign debt. They didn't borrow. They had very little foreign exchange reserves. They had a completely closed capital account. And their currency was not convertible, even on the trade account. So they really were polar opposites on just about any criteria you can think of in 1972.
The United States of America and the People's Republic of China have agreed to recognize each other and to establish diplomatic relations as of January the 1st, 1979. The United States recognizes the government of the People's Republic of China as a sole legal government of China.
Professor Susan Shirk holds the chair in China and Pacific Relations at the University of California and is the author of China, Fragile Superpower.
Well, China and the United States resumed diplomatic and political relations just at exactly the same time that China, under Deng Xiaoping, initiated its market reform and opening, changing its economic system from a Soviet-style, centrally planned command economy to introducing market mechanisms, profit incentives, competition, and opening up to foreign trade and investment. Now, the original motivation for economic relations was not economic, it was strategic. It was to find common cause against the Soviet threat. And, of course, that started back in 1971. But by the time we actually managed to establish diplomatic relations, the economic motivation was becoming more important. But still, for the first decade or more, economic trade and investment was kind of a trickle, really very small amount compared to what you see today.
Beginning in the late 70s, the United States assumed a larger role in China's trade, particularly on the export side. And also, as they began a lot of major development projects, they imported increasing amounts of capital goods from the United States. You know, electric power generation equipment, all the things that they really needed to develop a more modern, rapidly growing economy that they could not produce domestically at the time, came increasingly from the United States and, of course, from other OECD countries as well. It was mostly purchased with Chinese earnings from foreign exchange. Remember, China was a big oil exporter at this time. They developed their petroleum industry, and because their own economy was relatively small, at that time they had a big surplus of oil. And so oil was one of their major exports. Oil and certain other natural resources were actually a very important, primary products were a very important source of export earnings for China in the early 80s and even into the mid-1980s. They had not developed the labor-intensive manufactured goods, the textiles, clothing, and footwear that became so important by the late 80s. That came at a somewhat later stage. So in the early days of their opening up to the outside world, they were a major exporter of primary products.
During the 80s, China's successful East Asian neighbors began to set up shop there. First, Hong Kong's toy industry, then textiles, clothing, and footwear from Taiwan, Korea, and Japan. Electronic equipment has since joined the mix, and these days, for example, 90% of the world's laptop computers are made in China. Over half of all China's exports today are being produced by foreign firms operating in China. Unlike many other countries where labor is cheap, China has made things easy for foreign companies wanting to set up there. Parts and components imported in order to make things for export come into China free of duty, and the government has put a huge amount of money into infrastructure to make sure that companies can export their products in a cost-efficient way. Even American companies have set up business in China, although Nick Lardy says that these firms are largely interested in China's domestic market.
A number of very well-known American firms have had considerable success in China. This starts with automobile companies. General Motors is making, to the extent to which it makes any money these days, it makes it in China. They have a very large share of the market. Companies like Caterpillar are producing wheel loaders and other kinds of heavy construction equipment in China. It's being sold on the domestic market because in the early stages of economic development, the investment rate is very high. Investment in China this year will be about $1 trillion U.S. dollars. And that means a big demand. A lot of that is in construction, so there's a big demand for construction equipment. So American companies, which tend to be in the more capital-intensive industries, have invested in China, but they're more likely to be selling their output on the domestic market than our Asian firms have invested in China, which tend to be more export-oriented. So the Asian companies are tending to use China as an export platform, if you will, whereas American companies are being attracted to China by the large size of the domestic market.
Is there any sense in which you can say then that the growth of China has sucked out manufacturing jobs from the United States?
I think that is a very hard case to make. If you look closely at many of the American firms that are operating in China, the fact that they're producing in China actually creates more demand in the U.S. Lots of parts and equipment, the high value-added parts and equipment that go into those products are produced in the U.S., transferred from the parent in the U.S. to the subsidiary in China and go into a product that is then sold in China. I think with only about 4% unemployment in the United States today, the argument that we've lost 3 million manufacturing jobs to China, it just simply is not very plausible. Manufacturing has been declining as a share of our workforce for about 5 decades, and most of that reflects productivity growth that has made it possible to produce more and more output with fewer and fewer workers. If you look globally, in fact, over the last decade or so, when China's rise has become quite important, roughly from the actually a little bit more than a decade, the United States' share of global manufacturing output has remained relatively constant. Japan's has gone way down, some of the European countries have gone way down, but U.S. firms in general have been quite successful in maintaining their manufactured goods output. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't some sectors that are under heavy import competition, but to say that this is characteristic of the entire manufacturing sector in the United States, I think, is somewhat misleading.
There is a perception on the part of Americans that it has been harmful to the U.S. economy. But in fact, there's very little head-on-head competition with products manufactured in the United States. I mean, this is not the same as the U.S.-Japan trade frictions that we had back in the 70s and 80s. The Chinese are not yet manufacturing automobiles and exporting them to the United States, although that's likely to happen in the future. The products that China makes, if they weren't being made in China, they would probably be made in some other country and we would still be importing them. One thing, of course, that has been beneficial is that all of these low-price, pretty high-quality goods being imported by Americans, the stuff they buy at Walmart and Target, these big stores that are filled with Chinese light industrial manufacturing and electronics, they have helped keep inflation down in the United States because consumers are able to get more for their dollar by buying Chinese products than they would if they had to buy them from somewhere else.
You're tuned to ABC Radio National. This is Rear Vision with Keri Phillips. Today we're looking at the economic disequilibrium between China and the United States. When a country's currency falls in value, the goods it exports become cheaper. The falling US dollar allowed its trade deficit to fall to the lowest level in more than 2 years, according to figures released in September. But at the same time, its deficit with China rose 5.5% to almost $24 billion. Imports surged as American retailers stocked their shelves for Christmas with Chinese-made televisions, mobile phones, computers, and toys. While the US has much smaller trade imbalances with Canada, the European Union, and Mexico, the situation with China is complicated by the large reserves of US dollars it holds.
Well, China is the world's largest current account surplus country. In most years, they also have a surplus on their capital account because they have large amounts of foreign direct investment and certain other inflows of capital. So that means they're adding substantially to their foreign exchange reserves every year. By the middle of this year, they reached about $1.3 trillion, which is far and away the largest foreign exchange reserves of any country. They went up by another couple hundred billion in the third quarter, so that by the end of September, they're something around $1.4, almost $1.5 trillion U.S. dollars. So you have to hold those reserves in some form. Obviously, they're held in the form of mostly bonds that earn interest, and so the choice the government faces is, well, how should we allocate our investments in foreign currency? How much should we hold in, you know, U.S. dollar bonds, euro bonds, yen bonds, Swiss franc bonds, Australian dollar bonds, whatever? Since the United States is their largest trading partner, and since a lot of their trade with other countries is carried out in U.S. dollars, they have tended to hold a fairly large portion of their reserves in dollar-denominated financial assets. Most people estimate that it's somewhere around two-thirds, 60% to maybe two-thirds of their holdings are invested in dollar-denominated assets. Now, the fear that many people have expressed, or some people have expressed, is, well, if the Chinese authorities woke up some morning and decided that for whatever reason they didn't want to hold all these dollar-denominated assets, they would sell them in favor of holding assets denominated in other currencies, and that would create a huge excess supply of these fixed-income instruments on the market, and the only way the market would absorb them would be a huge increase in interest rates. In other words, we have benefited as a country, the United States has benefited from this Chinese willingness to hold these dollar-denominated assets. The benefit we get is in lower interest rates than we would otherwise have, and that, of course, is one of the things that fed the housing boom in the United States that is now starting to come to an end. But if they would sell these bonds precipitously, they might drive up interest rates quite a bit, and particularly in the current environment where the authorities are trying to lower interest rates to offset other things that are going on, this could have major negative implications for the U.S. economy and could potentially, in an extreme case, tip it into a recession. But the more important question to ask is, what's the likelihood of the Chinese actually doing this? The minute it has become known that Chinese authorities are selling off a substantial portion of their holdings, the value of the dollar is going to fall, and China will take very large capital losses on the $1.5 trillion in assets that it already holds. In other words, let's just say for the point of argument, about a trillion of it is in U.S. dollar-denominated assets. Well, as soon as they start to sell significant amounts, the dollar will fall, and as they try to move those dollar assets into other currencies, they will be able to buy less and less of the assets denominated in other currencies because the value of their dollar holdings is going to go down. And since the stock of their dollar assets is so huge, the losses that they would suffer from starting down this path would be quite significant as a share of their GDP. And so it's not economically rational for them to contemplate selling off any of their existing holdings.
It means that our two countries are codependent. China, by loaning us money, is enabling us to continue to run very big budget deficits and consume a lot and not save very much. And that we are consuming in part by buying Chinese products. So it's not necessarily a negative thing, but I think most people would say that perhaps the United States should be saving more, run lower deficits, not consume quite so much, and at the same time on China's side, Chinese people should be spending more and buying more so that China is not as dependent as it now is on its exports. You know, the Chinese people have a very high savings rate because they don't have Social Security, they don't have a good health care system, and they're saving for a rainy day. They're saving for the security of their families. Therefore, they're not spending as much as they should, and that's why Chinese firms are exporting so much, because their domestic demand is weaker than it should be. And actually, our government has been encouraging China to increase domestic demand, and the Chinese government is trying to do that. I mean, one way they do that, for example, is giving everybody these 3-week-long vacations in hopes that they will travel, spend money, whatever. So they are trying to stimulate domestic demand.
China's huge trade surplus and the high levels of foreign investment should, in theory, have pushed up the value of its currency. But because this would make China's exports more expensive, the Chinese government has tied the yuan to the U.S. dollar, keeping it artificially low.
Just in the last 3 or 4 years, the Chinese currency has become very, very undervalued, and this has provided a significant boost for China's exports. Now, a lot of people make statements that China's been doing this for decades, it's the old East Asian pattern, but that's not really true. China's currency for all of the 1980s and for much of the 1990s was actually overvalued, which meant they were penalizing exporters and subsidizing importers. Then they went to a more of an equilibrium kind of exchange rate in the mid-1990s, and that served them fairly well for a number of years. But in the last 3 to 4 years, their currency, because it's been tied to the dollar, has become significantly undervalued. Remember, the dollar has been declining since its peak of February 2002, and since China was tied to the U.S. dollar, it has gone down with the value of the dollar. And more recently, combine that with the very high growth of productivity, and that has meant that Chinese goods have become more and more competitive on global markets. And as of last year, this is reflected in the fact that China has now the biggest global current account surplus. The current account is the most comprehensive measure of a country's trade and other non-financial transactions with the rest of the world. And they had a current account surplus that was $250 billion last year. This year it will be more than $400 billion. And as a size, relative to the size of its economy, China's surplus now is about three times the all-time high the Japanese had in the mid-1980s before their currency began to appreciate. So their currency has gone badly off the track since really about 2002 and 2003, and so they now have a very, very large trade surplus and a global current account surplus. And this sounds a little bit abstract, but the important thing is that eventually the currency will have to come back closer to its true value. And when that happens, a lot of the investments that were made when the currency was at a disequilibrium value will not be economically viable. In other words, today the currency vis-a-vis the dollar is about 7.5, but if it went to 5, a lot of exports that seem to be profitable today would not be profitable because the dollar that you earn from selling on the domestic market would only translate into 5 Chinese domestic currency units, whereas today it translates into 7.5. And since you need to pay for your labor and your inputs and your electric bill and so forth in domestic currency, if you're only earning 5 instead of 7.5, that's a very significant difference.
Why has China tied its currency to the U.S. dollar?
I think it's been probably the most significant policy error that has been made in the last 30 years. What they really have failed to recognize is that when they're pegged to the dollar and they have very, very rapid productivity growth, as particularly has been true over the last decade, their goods will become more and more competitive and they'll have a bigger and bigger global surplus. And it is, I think, simply explained, as I said, the biggest policy error that they've made in the last 30 years.
What are the long-term implications of this relationship between these two economic and political giants?
I think the biggest long-term risk is that these global imbalances will not be sustainable. You know, the amount of money we owe the rest of the world continues to go up significantly every year, and it's also going up somewhat as a share of our GDP. And many people worry, and I think with some justification, that eventually the rest of the world will decide it's got enough dollar-denominated assets and they're not going to buy anymore. And that would force a very painful adjustment on the U.S. economy, which would have to take the form of increasing our savings to cover our investment, and that means reducing consumption and, again, would probably tilt the U.S. economy into a recession. It's a codependent relationship. We each gain something from it, and neither will be willing or likely to curtail it unilaterally. And so some people have said it's like the drug dealer and the addict. The United States is the addict. We are addicted to consumption, and we consume almost everything we produce, if not more. We have very low savings. So to finance our investment, we have to borrow from the rest of the world. So the rest of the world is, and China in particular, is the dealer. You know, they're lending us the money to keep our habit going, and our habit is high consumption and low savings. So like any codependent relationship, it's a complicated one and one that's very difficult to gradually unwind to get you to a different position.
I think it's worth pointing out that these trade frictions between China and the United States have become an important, serious political obstacle to managing relations between China and the United States. You know, when I was part of the WTO negotiations with China for its accession to the WTO in 1999, I was in Beijing. I remember one night with Charlene Barshefsky, who was our trade negotiator, and I said to her, gee, I'll know that we really have achieved success when the biggest problem in U.S.-China relations is trade. Because, of course, at the time, we're worried about human rights, proliferation, you name it. We had so many contentious issues with China. But I had no idea it was going to happen so quickly. But really, if you look at American domestic politics and attitudes toward China, the biggest issue is this massive trade deficit, larger than one we've ever had with any country.
Professor Susan Shirk, whose most recent book is called China, Fragile Superpower. Jenny Parsonage is the sound engineer for Rear Vision today. I'm Keri Phillips. Bye till next time.
been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.